The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager, and I am live for the next hour on Voice of Reason Radio Network on this very fine August 22nd. I want to take a little time here at the beginning to finalize and clarify the manner in which to send money for the Einsatzgruppen book. This is a project that three of our business have been committed to carrying out for a while now, but the holdup has been money. And as I said previously, they have the complete microfilm that was secretly stored in the Soviet Union until it was finally released, sometime after the fall of that regime. Can't say exactly when. But it has to be turned into CDs that can be read on a computer screen so they can make use of it. So this is an expensive process, currently about 3,500 euros, which translates to around over 5,000 U.S. It keeps getting worse, a little bit worse, for the United States. So I am trying to encourage as many of you as possible to send as much as you can. We have many listeners in Europe, of course, and their contributed money won't lose any value from exchange, as will the money of we Americans. But that's the way it goes. We can't worry about that. Australian and Canadian money has held up much better also. So, and you don't have to be living in a traditionally white country either to donate. Any kind of money works. Now, the best, this is what I've been having, it's probably my fault for being a little dense about all this, but and making it seem more difficult than it is, that we now know that the best and easiest method to send your contribution is through PayPal. Carlo Matonio is in Italy, and he is in possession of the microfilm, and he has a PayPal account. So if you have a PayPal account, simply log into it, click on Send Money, and then fill in the toolbox with his email address. That's all. No name, just the email address. Fill in the amount in your own currency. For Americans, it would be dollars, of course. And it will show you, I think it showed me, how many euros that will be. So click on done or continue or whatever they say next, and then you will be asked for your credit or debit card information. And your money will be credited directly to Carlo's account. If you don't have a PayPal account, just go to PayPal homepage and click on Send Money and follow the same procedure. Now, to the email address, I asked Carlo this morning if it was all right to publicize his email address. I mean, I sent him that question in an email, but I haven't gotten an answer yet. So just in case, I'm not going to give it out. And I will ask you to email me for it at carolyn@carolynyeager.com. And I will then email it to you. I'll just reply to you with his email address. I don't think he can expect any more privacy than that. So this is the plan, ladies and gentlemen. And I hope you will contribute to this project. It doesn't matter what the amount is now, how large or how small, because it's not going to be coming through me. It's going to be going directly to him. So whatever you can do will help to bring it to the total that's needed. And I think that giving people a way to be a part of the effort, to know that they have helped, is a way to build community in our very widely spaced out movement. So I do hope that I will be getting lots of emails starting right after this program or right now asking for Carlo's email address. And I'll keep you up to date as best as I'm able as to how this is progressing. And now my guest has been waiting patiently, and I'm so pleased to introduce him. He is someone I've had the pleasure of meeting and knowing in person. Mr. James Damon of Austin, Texas. Hello, James.
Hello, Carolyn, and everyone else.
Okay. Well, we're glad you're here. Now, to introduce you to some people who might not know you, you are best known now for translations from German to English of important documents that you've made available to a wide reading audience through the Internet. Isn't that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Sounds good.
All right.
And one of the translating.
Well, it's a good thing you do, because I'll tell you, people who get the translations sure enjoy having them, because otherwise we would have no way of reading these particular, getting this particular information. And if we, because nobody else is doing it. So we're going to find out why you do it and how you got around to doing it. But one of the last things you sent out is a news release for, or I should say news release, the 4th August 2011. This was just early in the month. And it says, title, Concerning My Alleged Collaboration with the Stasi, from Horst Mahler, who is currently one of the imprisoned revisionists in Germany. And you have translated a lot of Mahler's communiques. You've also translated a lot of German court proceedings of those who are termed Holocaust revisionists. So do you have, could you explain anything about this, what you last sent from Horst Mahler, what was going on with that, why he was defending himself about being a collaborator with the Stasi, the East Germans?
No, I wish I could provide some special insight, but I translate things that are requested, and Kevin Kester asked that I translate that. He works closely with Horst, as you might know.
Okay. Well, no, I didn't know that.
I don't know any of these people. I've only spoken to Horst briefly one time over the telephone.
Well, I don't think anybody knows Horst too well, except a few people over there. So that's not, you know, that's not unusual. But Kevin Kathner is the one who is, or Kather, is the one who is most in touch with Horst, eh? He's very active.
His name is Kevin Kather, actually, K-A-U-M-A-T-H-E-R.
Yeah, Kather. Okay, thank you. I always forget that the T-H is a T. You know, I'm just real slow with this stuff anymore. Kevin's very active, and you've translated quite a few things that he's written, and also, right?
Yes. He himself has been to court, as you might know, and won a victory of sorts.
Yes, that's right. He's one of the first ones who had a victory. And do you know if he's what he's doing now? Has he got something new in the works, or what? He has a family. He has young, very young children.
Yes, like Dirk Timmerman. I believe they're friends. They're both members of the self-accusation movement, I guess we should call it. They filed charges against themselves for expressing doubts about you-know-what.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, let's get on to you. I just wanted to get people situated as to what kind of work you do. Now, you call yourself a Germanist Germanophile. I find that very intriguing, because you've also said, you wrote to me in an email recently, that not all Germanists are Germanophiles. Now, I'm intrigued by that, so I want to know how that works, but I also want to hear all about you and how you got into doing this and why you are a Germanophile.
Well, it's very true. Not all Germanists are Germanophiles. A Germanophile being one who is, I think, always gives the Germans the benefit of the doubt. Different people will have their own, versions of that. But a Germanist is obviously someone who has professional training in Germanism, Germanic languages and literature. So far.
Well, that makes great deal of sense. Thank you.
I'm an old timer here, and so many years ago, over 50 years ago, the government had a crash program to produce Germanists, not particularly Germanophiles. That was called the National Defense Education Act. And I just happened to be coming along in time to get one of those three-year, $10,000 fellowships, which was a lot of money in those days.
Yes. Well, good for you. And so then what happened? Keep going.
Well, I taught for a few years, and the government, basically Vietnam came along, and the Cold War became a hot war, and unfortunately the National Defense Education Act had been funded through the War Department, or Defense Department, to use its Orwellian name. And when Vietnam heated up, they lost interest in that Cold War measure, the National Defense Education Act, and they dropped it.
Oh, yeah. So I was a little slow there. So they wanted Germanists at that time because of the Cold War. How do they think that? What was the political interest?
Well, this was called the Sputnik. It's also known as the Sputnik Fellowships.
Okay.
They were in a number of different science fields of study. You know, Congress really panicked when the Sputnik went up. And when was that, October 57 or sometime around then?
Mm-hmm.
And so, well, they really panicked. They said, the Russians are winning, the Russians are winning. Why? And somebody said, well, they teach foreign languages in their school. And so, okay, we're going to stress foreign languages. And so they passed out these, you know, really lovely graduate fellowships, and I was lucky to get one.
All right, and you and
it may be an example of doing the right thing for the wrong reason. I don't know, but
well, you got. Do you have a graduate degree then in German? Is that it?
Yes, I never finished a dissertation. I have a master's degree.
Oh, you just didn't finish your dissertation. That's all, huh? You got. Maybe you got politically discouraged, huh?
Yeah, well, suddenly there's a huge glut of Germanists on the market, and my wife was lucky to get a teaching job, but I wandered off into real estate.
Okay, all right. Well, then go on with what all that happened after that.
Well, you want me to just...
Well, you mentioned the highlights, like you told me, I thought this was quite interesting. Now, your name, Damon, I never asked you what that name was, what ethnicity it represented, but I don't think it's German, but you do have
that's an English name.
Uh-huh.
It was a Norman that's derived from Damont, the old French for coming from the mountains. According to our cousin Dick, who's a family genealogist, but it's a German name.
Oh, it is a German name.
I mean, I'm sorry, it's an English name. It's a corruption of an old French, a Norman name, we'll say. I'm going to say Norman, not German.
Yeah, okay, I got it. And then, but you had a great Aunt Mildred. Tell us about your great Aunt Mildred Baumgarten.
Really? Oh, she was lovely. She was descended from the first German settlement in Texas, which was an industry. And she was a descendant of the Walters family, which were quite prominent. Her cousin, Jake Walters, I believe, was attorney general at one time in the 1920s. Don't know exactly. But she was a dear. She had raised two boys, and she knew what little boys like. And so she was always full of funny stories and good things to eat. And
yeah.
Like a gas house egg. I bet you don't know what a gas house egg is.
No, I don't.
Well, that's a corruption of Gasthaus Ei. And it's just an egg fried in a slice of bread down with butter. I never knew until recently where the term actually came from.
Oh.
But at any rate, I was very fond of my Aunt Mildred. I spent a good bit of time with her. And our family always referred to her as a German, so I sort of associated her with Germans, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Had a positive impression.
Right. Early on. From the age of five or so.
Now you say.
One of the first fights
I got into was over my Aunt Mildred. Uh-huh. The little boy that lived next door to my grandmother's house in Houston, his father had just been drafted. So he said his daddy was going to kill all the Germans. And I took that as a threat on against my Aunt Mildred. So I poked him in the snout, and he didn't say that anymore.
Oh, he didn't fight back, huh? Hey, big tough guy, huh? Well, that was okay. So that happened at age five. So you were an early lover of all things German because of your Aunt Mildred. Now, you say that, what I wanted to go to from there was that, what do you think, why do you think that Germans then, so many people think, oh no, I know what I was going to say, sorry. This is the way we do when we're live, James, get kind of, you know, anything, things get a little mixed up, but it's okay. Getting close. So you always have lived in Texas. You're Texas born and bred?
Yes.
Okay. Well, but you're not really a typical Texan. Now,
the uncle of my great great grandmother was killed at the Alamo.
Oh well, you really are a Texan.
How about that?
Yeah. You have quite a history, and you're a modest person. But you are also involved with the German Institute in Austin. Can you tell us a little bit about that? I visited there when I was in Austin.
It's called the German Texan Heritage Society. We have a website. It's non-political, of course. But we also have a German free school that's in the original building here in Austin that was built in 1857. This was the first school in Austin that was open to the public. It was not until the 1870s that we got around to public schools.
Okay.
So I teach the informal voluntary courses there, a course in the structure of the German language, and then one that we call the highlights of the German-Texan experience. 19th century, 1840s.
Well, I wish they had something like that where I live, because I would like to learn about the structure of the German language. That's my problem in learning German.
The colleges, the junior colleges, are complaining that that interest in foreign language in German is dying out, and they're dropping their German courses. But our program is growing. We find growing interest instead of diminishing.
Well, they've done that around here, too. And that's why you can't find any German classes. And it's really too bad. It probably has diminished. But the people in Austin are able to come to your institute. And they're fortunate in that. Well, we need to promote Germanism, I think. I try to do that a little bit. And in speaking about that, we have this article by Manfred Kleine Hartlager that you have just translated. And
Thank you for bringing that to my attention. I found it very interesting.
Well, I did too. And I sent it to you and knowing you could read it in German. And then I was very pleased that you started translating it. And Manfred is pleased also, and he's going to post it on his German Views website, the translation, because it's an English language website.
Well, you contacted him.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I have already.
Why didn't I think of that?
Yeah. Well, he's very nice, and I was trying to handle it with the Google Translator. I could really, reading your translation, I saw some places where I got kind of confused. But let's talk about that just a little bit. I like the part that he goes into. This is just part one. It's three parts, but you've translated part one, which might be the most interesting to me because it's the background of why this anti-Germanism exists, or what's called the anti-German narrative. So he talks about utopian and non-utopian worldviews, which I find very helpful and interesting. And then he uses a terminology, and I was looking for it and haven't found it now, but the global civil war, or is it the global political global civil war or something? I have to go to the site now and see. Do you remember that? What this latest onslaught
is? Yes, he mentioned 1789. He mentions the French Revolution. But I do believe that he's referring to the rationalists, the French rationalists, who, of course, were active in mid or maybe even early 18th century. I don't know. I don't want to masquerade as an expert on that period.
Well, but I think you know more than you're letting on. I mean, I think you're just as, you know, as much as most people do. Maybe not the most, you know, maybe not as much as the particular scholars, but I think you understand it pretty well. I think that term, global civil war, and there's four words in it. I think maybe that's in part two. Because I don't.
Okay, I'm scrolling down as we speak. Mm-hmm. So what he wrote was, or what I translated, one cannot understand these concepts of history, that is utopianism, unless one understands the historical context of European civil war that has been raging since 1789. Well, that's mm-hmm. obviously a reference to the French Revolution, which continues today. He's actually referring to a work by the authors Hanno Kestink and that was a different one. This is just Kestink's work, which translates as The Philosophy of History and Global Civil War, The Significance of the History of the French Revolution to the East-West Conflict, published in 1959.
Yes.
Yeah, well, this is very informative, and Manfred is careful to give his, he is a professional political scientist, I understand, and so mm-hmm. he's careful to give his sources for these things. I haven't read Kestink's book, so I can't say a whole lot about it.
Well, I haven't either, and I'm not going to since it's in German. But I think we could just go for what Manfred has written here, and he definitely does. And so he's not the only one who dates our current world views from the French Revolution, and that is created an idea of a utopia based on fraternity, égalité, and liberty, you know. And the key word is equality, making, you know, everyone equal. It was kind of a combination of a Freemasonic, communist, inspired revolution. Would you say? I'm really simplifying it, but...
Well, yeah, that's my impression.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And he calls these two, he calls the two utopians, one liberalism and how it has developed, and the other socialism, which could also be, you know, include communism, that type of socialism. And, as these two branches of utopian worldviews that he says go back to a common meta ideology, you know, they really have a common source. And which is basically, he keeps repeating, a utopian worldview. And then he describes a utopian worldview, which is very much the way we see things today, we who consider ourselves on the right. And he calls the other, non-utopian, the conservatism or reaction or simply the political right. And then he goes on to compare the two in four different ways, which I think is very enlightening. Of course, naturally, first, man is by nature good is the utopian idea, and therefore...
That comes from Rousseau, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. There you go. And the French. Yeah. And because man is by nature good, social conditions are what cause all the problems. And if we change the social conditions, which is how we see liberalism today and what communism tells us, then everything will be just hunky-dory, right?
Of course, in this regard, we have to mention that Manfred is talking about cultural liberalism rather than British economic liberalism or laissez-faire. This is a bit confusing because the term liberalism often means different things to different people.
Oh, yes, it does. And you're right. Thank you for making that point. So we will say cultural liberalism because I think that's right. What he's writing about, what he's concerned about, is all about culture. And, of course, he's a German who's very concerned about what's happening to Germany and German culture and and points to immigration as being a big problem. Well, we have come to the halfway point already, James. I hear the music, and it gets loud pretty fast, so I'm going to say, listeners, stay tuned.
We'll be right back with more on The Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Hopes for a Mideast peace agreement have been dealt a fresh blow, with Hamas announcing it's pulling out from a de facto ceasefire with Israel. The statement follows 2 days of Israeli airstrikes on Gaza that saw more than a dozen killed. Let's cross live now to Tel Aviv, where RT's Paula Sleer joins us. Paula, how would this statement by Hamas affect what's already a very volatile situation?
Well, as you say, Hamas says it will no longer adhere to a truce. Now, they say that there's no proof that these attacks, which happened on Thursday, originated from Gaza. In fact, they deny this, despite the fact that Israel insists that Gaza is to blame. Now, the Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas, is calling for an emergency United Nations Security Council meeting. He's calling on the international community to denounce and to call on Israel to stop these attacks. The latest figures we have are some 15 Palestinians who have been killed in a round of Israeli airstrikes that have been ongoing since late Thursday. We are also being told that the situation on the ground is intensifying, and there are no indications that the situation will let up anytime soon. Now, as far as the Israeli side goes, they say that Hamas, the Islamic Jihad, and the Popular Resistance Committees that it holds responsible for Thursday's attacks are responsible for some more than 30 Grad and Qassam rockets that have been fired on Israel since Thursday. So what we're witnessing on the ground is a situation that is intensifying and intensifying quickly.
What about the people in Tel Aviv where you are? How are they feeling about this latest announcement from Hamas about the ceasefire?
Well, most Israelis are very afraid that there could be a full-scale war between Israel and Gaza, and in the last conflict there were a number of casualties on both sides. But having said that, it is now more than 4 weeks since Israeli protesters have taken to the streets asking and demanding from the government that it address their socio-economic problems. Organizers of these demonstrations say that this latest wave of violence is not unexpected. They very much anticipated that the Israeli government would use anything to detract attention from their complaints and their concerns. And earlier we spoke to one of the organizers who said that they were sympathizing with the victims of the violence and that they were still planning to go ahead tonight with a candlelight demonstration showing solidarity for those who have been killed. Let's take a listen.
Tonight, we're going to march together in silence in order to respect the victims of this conflict. We're very disappointed by the government's reaction that immediately said and tried to use our pain in order to stop this social protest. And we disagree. The social protest is going to continue, and we're going to keep fighting for our rights, and we're going to keep doing it together, and we're not going to allow this conflict to stop us.
Paula, what does this latest flare-up mean, of tensions, I should say, mean for the upcoming UN vote on...
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Well, welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. And my guest is James Damon, who is here with me on the phone, that is. And we have been talking about this latest very interesting article by Manfred Kleine Hartlage on the anti-German narrative that James has translated into English. And it is available on my website, and I will give a link to it. I posted it there. The first time I posted some writing that wasn't my own, pretty much, but I thought I need to have it posted somewhere so I could link to it. So that's what I did. And it is going to be on German Views pretty soon. But we both think this is interesting because we're both Germanophiles. So we're talking about his contrasting utopian and non-utopian worldviews as the major, ideological difference in the West since the French Revolution. Would you say that, James?
Yes. I'm scrolling as you speak. Did you want to mention the basic assumptions that he lists, the utopian ideologies?
Yes. Go ahead with that.
Yeah, Manfred lists four of them. He writes that, firstly, utopian societies hold that man is by nature good. Well, as we observe, that Alf Klew, that's enlightenment, isn't it? That comes from Rousseau. But the approach of the right is that man is inadequate and weak, and he has to rely on a social order of some sort. And
yes.
Manfred's second assumption that he mentioned is that the utopian ideologies hold that society can be rationally planned. It's all a matter of reason and enlightenment, again. So you can micromanage down to the last detail and come up with a perfect society that way. But Manfred observes that the right are Germans, by contrast. This is, we might say, Germans who want to be German, to use one of Horst Mahler's terms. But the right believes that what is traditional and established can be destroyed by criticism, but it cannot be replaced by anything better, you know, through these rational processes. And Manfred lists what cannot be replaced by rationalism, and he names the concepts of family, faith, tradition, and fatherland. These mm-hmm. are what he associates with the right. The third assumption that Manfred lists is that utopian societies hold that what is good can be rationally inferred. That is to say, the good is culturally independent and universally valid. So in other words, the French revolutionists, for example, really believe that what was good for the French proletariat would be good for everyone.
Oh, that's right. And here's where we really get down into the nitty-gritty and where we get into the, communist philosophy. Now, if there's a better word than communist, you can use it, but I find myself using that word more and more. But, this philosophy, which is the utopian philosophy, really.
Yeah, unfortunately, it doesn't mean different things to different people.
Yeah.
But it is like the cultural liberalism, it is utopian insofar as it relies on what should be or could be rather than what actually exists, I believe
exactly.
Is the way he explains it.
Exactly. And so, and this utopianism, I mean, they're always aiming and they're always promising. So the politicians are always promising these wonderful results and some kind of freedom from all problems if they just can do this next war or they just can carry out these next policies or if they just can take away a little more from you and get a little more taxes and so on. This is
hey,
basically...
You are just now stating Manfred's fourth assumption.
Okay.
That is that utopian societies harbor the belief that society has to be defined and analyzed according to their utopian standards. And these standards comprise a standpoint of norms, he says, rather than facts. So the utopians, the socialists, the liberals, or the communists are concerned with what should be rather than what is.
I mentioned that you now. I might not bring this up because it's kind of, but you know, when Robert Kennedy quoted that, I see, he's got that famous quote. It actually didn't come from him. It came from George Bernard Shaw. But people now think that, you know, they associate it with him. He said, in that famous speech, I look and see, what should be there and not what is or something. And see, that was considered very inspiring and very wonderful. And no matter what you might think of Robert Kennedy or the Kennedys or whatever, I'm not trying to put down the Kennedys, but that is that there it is. There's evidence of that philosophy that we should create what should be, and what is we should somehow defeat or get rid of or destroy. And I think that the conservative view, and I don't like the word conservative too much, but the right view is that we have to deal with what is, and there really is no should be. What do you say about that?
Well, yes, that's my understanding of the way Manfred presents it. Yes. For the utopian, what should be trumps what is.
Yeah.
You know, the utopians, the liberals, or the communists, to use Manfred's terms, are concerned with what should be rather than what is.
Now, there is a place where I find that this doesn't all hold together. Because I like it very much, but because Manfred is for the church, that's part of his, you know, faith, and he's very much for the Christian church, which I agree with, in order to hold, the West together, I think that's a good idea. But he says that the utopian concept produces the politics of a struggle between light and darkness. And truthfully, I see the church is being adapted to that also, because they portray things as between the powers of light and darkness. But then they don't say that in this world we're going to conquer darkness and have it all light. Do they?
No, not to my knowledge.
Well, you know, this might seem a little simple, but, you know, these kind of simple ideas are very profound. I mean, as to understanding how do you look at it? Because the kind of political correctness that is aimed at us all the time is based on these these basic ideas of what is good, of what is the good, right?
Yes, what's presented as the good, which in decadent societies, of course, will coincide with the interests of the ruling class or the power elite, as it's called.
Well, yes, and so now if we talk about what is good, we have to say, well, we look at today, and to the utopians, immigration, world immigration, not just immigration into Western societies, although that's where most of it is concentrated, because that's where others want to go, but immigration all over, you know, mixing everyone up all over the world, they call the good.
Yes, that's a liberalist virtue.
And if we call it not good, and if we call not doing that good, well, then we are called all kinds of names. And so it's kind of important to understand where this comes from, which it does come from the ideas that became prevalent at became prevalent and then resulted in the French Revolution. Which was really pivotal.
Yeah, basically, be reasonable, see it my way.
Right. Well,
I don't know how relative we want to be here, but
okay.
But you know, there may be a slight contradiction here in Montfort's prison. I'd love to discuss it with him, but actually, Montfort lists faith as one of the what you would say, virtues of the conservatives, religion and faith. But might faith be construed as utopianism too?
Well, that's what I was saying. Yeah, because it is a utopianism after this world, you know, following, not in this world, but there's a promise of a world after
pie
death.
What did Joe Hill call it, pie in the sky when we die?
Yes, well, so there's another big conflict that we have between those who follow that and those who don't. So I like to see these big bold themes, and I say, well, here it is all laid out, but then you always find some little things that don't quite fit, and then you have to figure out how you're going to fit that, and that shows that nothing ever all fits together for everyone. And therefore, I do think the idea that life is a continual struggle, and that people need to band together in ways in which they are similar and they get along and they have similar roots and so on, and band together and do the best they can to make their area of the world as good as possible, without trying to take over all other people's areas. And I think this world idea is what is the problem.
Was it Plato who observed that the unexamined life is not worth living?
Well, yes, he did. I think so.
So we have to always ask questions.
Well, yeah, but what I'm saying is that I think that the idea that the whole world must follow a certain path is where the big problem is, as much as what Montfort is pointing out here. And that this is why I'm a nationalist, in that we, you know, we have to allow each area to function on its own. And then I don't think that means, see, well, they put across this big lie following the French Revolution and other big major changes following that. They put across this big
lie
that nationalism was
a reason
for wars.
To deceive, was it?
Yeah. Yeah, that war was caused because people had competitive interests.
Yeah.
And yet, really, most of these wars, these competitive interests could have been negotiated and worked out, but war was caused because the world, those who wanted this world utopian view to take over, these utopian ideologies, they were finagling behind the scenes to create war and force war. That's what I would say.
Yes. Knights and the Jacobins paved the way for Napoleon, didn't they?
Well, I maybe so. I'm not familiar with that.
With their ideals and utopian strivings and so forth, they actually just ushered in Napoleon, then someone who was decisive and not really plagued with all these abstractions. You know,
yes.
He wanted to be the dictator of the world. He wanted to rule the world.
I'm not sure what he
was. Very utopian. Would you consider Napoleon utopian?
No. And you know, I don't know very much when it comes to Napoleon. Of course, I've heard of, you know, I know of him all my life, but I never really studied him in any kind of depth. So I'm kind of ignorant there. But I wouldn't say. I think he was practical. I don't know if he wanted. Did he want to rule the world? It was a French magnificence or something like that.
Well, at least he wanted his family to rule all Europe.
Okay.
Ruled France and right.
Yeah. Well, we don't want things to get so big. When things get so big, when you get these big ideas. As the United States has today, then you know you've gone too far. It's no good. Now let's switch. So because I'm getting a little lost here, so let's switch to what's going on in Germany today, and this recent commemoration of the building of the Berlin Wall that took place, and some little incidents that shed a lot of light on Germany. What's your overall view of the situation in poor Germany? And how do you see anything, how do you see any progress being made or any help coming along? Do you see anything, any good signs?
Gee, you might know more about the Berlin Wall than I do.
Well, not about the Berlin Wall. We can bring that into it. But just in general, Germany.
I too have the impression that things are coming to a head in Germany. Even Angela Merkel, who was a apparatchik under the old Stalinist regime, you know, even she is coming out and saying that multiculturalism doesn't work, hasn't worked, has been a big flop.
Well, she kind of has to say that. She's mollifying certain areas of her voter bloc, I guess. She says multiculturalism doesn't work, but then she says we have to work harder at assimilation. She doesn't say, and she says you're going to have all these. Says you're going to have all these people, and you're going to have mosques, and you're going to have more crime, and you're going to have this, and you're going to have that. You know, she says German people. That's just the way it is. She is not saying, well, we need to turn anything around and go back the other way, which is what people like Manfred are saying, and what I would be saying if I were there. Right?
Yes, that's true.
Yeah. So I wonder now this Saracen.
But you know, it's the situation is more complex because the Germans, as I know it, have developed a sort of coded language, a cryptic language. Freedom of speech is really not native to the continent, Voltaire notwithstanding. You know, the French and the Germans are not like British cousins. They don't place a great deal of emphasis on the individual's right to, you know, just utter whatever comes to his mind.
Okay,
so they,
good point.
Yeah, over the years, they've sort of learned to talk around it. Well, I don't want to get lost into that, but...
Well, you would understand that, knowing the language better than some. I think you're right. They do talk around it, but are you saying that you think that Angela Merkel is more serious about some of these things than I think she is?
Yes, well, she's really an amazing creation, isn't she? The idea that an apparatchik, you know, that was so vilified in the Federal Republic, should suddenly have all the credentials that the government wants after reunification. You see what I'm trying to say? Who would ever have guessed 20 years ago or 30 years ago that someone who was so much a part of the Stalinist apparatus would have such a glorious career in the so-called Federal Republic?
Well, so you go along with the idea that she really was very much a Stalinist, and you don't think that she could have changed that much?
Well, she was in the youth branch, of course.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she wasn't old enough to be all that fossilized. She's a very versatile person, obviously. She's able to change her colors.
Well,
that
would be the question, whether she's actually changed her colors or just is able to look like she's changed her colors. But, you know, where's the best direction for Germany to go? I'm not saying that the Western way is the best. Look at Britain. They have a worse immigration problem than almost anybody on the continent, except I guess for France. It's hard to tell who has it worse, but they both have it worse than Germany has at this point. But it's getting worse there. So, you know, I don't know about you, James, but I mean, I'm very, very sympathetic with those who are really fighting against the immigrants in Europe.
Isn't that incredible? Yeah, that the nationalists would be collaborating with one another in the 21st century. I mean, who would have thought, you know, 50 year, or 70 years ago that the British nationalists and the French nationalists and the German nationalists would be supporting one another?
All right. So, yes, and you see that as you think that's really good, and they really are, and you think they're going to be able to continue to do that?
Well, I hope that there's some sort of European nationalism emerging from all this. I mean, obviously, the Germans and the French, there's no future if they continue warring with one another.
The Germans and the French?
Right.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, well, I don't want to pontificate about it. It's a complex problem.
Well, it is.
But it is interesting that you hear more and more. Let's see, was it, I'm having a senior moment here. Who observed that the wrong side won the war? The American?
Mm-hmm.
Senator John McCain. Suddenly, that's everybody is saying the wrong side won the war, and not just the Vietnam War, you know. So who would have thought that the nationalists in Germany, France, and England would agree on that point?
Oh, yes. Well, because they're all against the European Union. You see, that's what brings them together. You know, as soon as you have a common enemy, that's what brings you together.
Yes, and what we might call the Zionist American re-education of Germany has become a re-education of all Europe, hasn't it? I mean, they've been culturally colonized, just like Germany has.
Well, you're
exactly
right.
The French resent that very much. Nowadays, you're better off passing yourself off as a German than an American, you know, in France.
Okay, yeah. Well, there you go. That's bringing the Europeans are coming together in their realization of their common enemy, which is the European Union and is the United States and Anglo-Americanism, and is also, even though there are those in Britain who aren't who are you know, with the nationalists, but and also against immigration. That's what's bringing them all together. And maybe if this keeps growing, of course, the media does everything to make it kind of get in the way of it. The big problem is the media, but that's been talked about a million times. So look at, oh, here we are already at the end of the program. We didn't get to talk about Udo Voigt and his gas, step on the gas campaign for his political party, for which he's been getting in a lot of trouble. He's criticized so harshly, whereas these communists who refused to stand up when they were talking about the victims of the Berlin Wall, they are finally being criticized, but they're not being attacked as bad as he is. So that's the way it goes there in Europe. And I think I want to. I'm never sure just how much time I have, and we really get put off. So let's kind of close out here, James. I want to thank you very much for being on the program. I hope people now, when they see your translations coming across their screen, will know a little bit more about the person who's done.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.